You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Well, you guys ready to get back in our study of 1 Peter? Yep. This is quite a spiritual meal, this little book, 1 Peter. Every passage is rich. There's not a single one that I found where it's like, oh, this one's easy. They all are pretty substantive. And one of the things that I like about this book, I think it's because of the context. You know, as you've heard me describe now many times, Peter's writing to a group of people who are enduring a long-term trial. And specifically that trial is that they are facing persecution, that they're, we've read in this book that they've been rejected, they've been slandered. They've been, people are saying things about them that are either untrue or misleading. People are suspicious of them. And there's a special kind of pain that comes with people, questioning your goodness. And that's what they're facing in their everyday lives. And so Peter's writing to encourage them. Well, in our study in the last few weeks, we've been kind of focused on this one topic, which is responding to slander. And that's because that's what this little section here in chapter 2 and into 3 is about. It's about what do you do? How do you respond when you discover that what people are saying about you isn't fair or isn't true or isn't correct? How do you respond? And Peter's answer to that has been, you respond in how you act, in what you do. What you do is so much more important than what you say. In other words, you need to demonstrate and show them not only who you are, but really who Christ is. And that this has been the emphasis. So we've been kind of working out of this important verse in verse 12 of chapter 2. He says, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God on the day of visitation. So that it's that people may see your good works, and not only that that might refute some of what is being said about you, but that also it may show them something about God, that it may ultimately lead to a reconciliation between them and God, and that on the day when Jesus returns, they'll be in right standing with him, glorifying him right along with you. That's the vision that he's casting. And so we've worked out of this verse for the last 3 weeks, as we've seen Paul has given three different examples. And then in chapter 3, verse 8, he concludes this whole section. And we dabbled a little in this last time, but this week we're really going to study it and then on the next 7 or 8 verses or so. So let's begin reading here in chapter 8, the conclusion of this whole section. He says, to sum up, and so that's kind of, he's letting us know, all right, now I'm just painting with a big brush. To sum up, all of you, he says, be harmonious, sympathetic, loving, compassionate, and humble, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. For you were called for the very purpose that you would inherit a blessing. For, he says, the one who desires life, to love and good and see good days, must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. He must turn away from evil and do good. He must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against evildoers. And who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not fear their intimidation, and don't be in dread. But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, but with gentleness and respect. And keep a good conscience, so that in the thing in which you are slandered, those who disparage your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame. So you see, he's still on this topic of slander and responding. And there's a lot in this conclusion that he draws here. But what I want to draw your attention to first is this line right here where he says, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you. It's kind of an amazing verse because he's imagining a scenario where he's like, people are going to be asking you, what is up with you? What is the deal with you? In a positive way, and that you need to be ready with an answer to that. And I think that's kind of an amazing assumption, you know, but he's assuming that they're going to take his teaching to heart, that if you live in the way that he's been describing, if we're truly characterized by exemplary behavior, that might prompt someone to wonder, what is going on with us? Where is that coming from? And, you know, I can actually relate to this. I was thinking back to when I first was hanging around with Christians as a young person that, you know, at first I was very unimpressed. I'll be honest with you. I was arrogant. I was, I was a terrible person at that point in my life. But I walked in the room and I thought, nah, this isn't going to be my crowd. My friends are way cooler, way funnier, way more interesting. Frankly, I'm kind of above this. I mean, I would never say that out loud, but that's what I thought, okay? And yet, something weird happened, which is that there was something winsome, right? There was something that kept drawing me in, and it confused me. I was too proud to ask out loud what it was, but I did wonder, what is it about this group of people that, even though I evaluate them to be not as good as my group of friends, they definitely have something that my group of friends does not have. There's something real. There's something authentic about them. There's something that I want to be around them. And I don't know if it's that they've got this purpose or that they've got this unity or just in the way that they are real about who they are that my group of friends can't do. I just remember being like, I need to come back and I want to be a part of this. What is that? And Peter's saying that is going to happen. And when that happens, you need to be ready with an answer. So I think here's what Peter's saying in this section. I think the main idea here is that we ought to live a life that demands an explanation. That's what he's saying. Live in such a way that it demands an explanation, that it raises eyebrows, that it turns heads, that people are like, I don't even know the question to ask, but I have a question about how you live. Live that kind of a life. That's the bar that he's setting for Christians. And then, flowing right from that, we need to have that explanation ready. So two big ideas. This is our outline for today. Part one and part two, two big ideas. Number one, live a life that demands an explanation. And number two, have that explanation ready. And so let's talk about these two ideas. First of all, we'll start with the first one. What does it mean to live a life that demands an explanation? You know, how do I do that? And luckily, Peter, I think, gives us a lot of that information in this summary. So what characterizes the Christian life that demands an explanation? I mean, there's many things we could say, but what does Peter say? And I think for that, we should go back to this verse 8, because he lists off this series of words to sum up all of you, be these ways. And then when people ask, be ready to explain. So what are the ways we're supposed to be? He says that we should be harmonious, which is the homophron, the idea that we should be of one mind or one heart. It literally means to think the same thing, that we're thinking along the same lines. It's a picture of unity. And it is one of the most amazing things about Christian fellowship is that, and that was one of the things that struck me back in those days, is like, this group of people doesn't make sense. You know, all these, socially, this group of people should not be together and getting along so well. How is that happening? That's happening because they've all come under the banner of something greater, which is Jesus Christ. Jesus said, by this, all people will know that you're my disciples if you have love for one another. This shows something outwardly to the world. He says we should be sympathetic. And the idea here, you know, if harmonious means to sort of think the same thing, this idea of sympathetic means to feel the same thing. It's the idea of sometimes it describes suffering alongside someone, but I think it's that idea of humanizing someone else, where you are trying to get into the shoes of someone else, trying to understand not just what they think, but also what they feel, what it might feel like to be that person in this situation. He says we should be loving. And you know, that can mean a lot of things. There are a lot of words for love in the Bible. This one is philadelphos, which is brotherly love. So that's a very specific type of love. There's romantic love and there's friendship love. But, you know, sibling love is its own special thing, right? That's a very special kind of relationship. Siblings, they might not even have friendship. You know, they might be at each other's throat, and yet there's still that kind of abiding loyalty, right? I have a sister. Our relationship is like that. There's a special bond that we have. This is a picture of my daughter at a dance recital. Isn't it adorable? Look, she's got her little toe pointed out there and flowers. That's what you call a frame-worthy picture right there. Only one problem with this picture. She has a little brother. And I love that picture because that says it all. If you ever wondered what it was like to have a little brother, there it is. That's his primary role in his life, is causing problems off to the side. But you know, and so you might think, well, they must fit each other's throat. And they do drive each other crazy from time to time. And yet, there's still this bond. There's still a deep type of friendship. It's different than their other friendships, but it's a special type. He says you should be characterized by a brotherly love. He says you should be compassionate, which is just the idea of, it's about your intent, that you're a genuine kind-heartedness, a genuine well-meaning intent toward the other people around you, which is the exact opposite of what they were being accused of. They are accused of having a secret ill intent toward humanity. He says, no, the only way to refute that is to be genuinely kind-hearted. God has goodwill toward men, and so should we. And then he says that we should be humble. And there are several words in the Bible for humble. This is the one that means humble-minded. It's like how you think of yourself, not as holier than thou, but as an ordinary person, a sinner saved by grace, like everyone else. And this idea is actually so important for Peter. He's going to develop it later, and we'll spend a whole teaching talking about the idea of humility in a little while later on. Now, here's the thing. I think that all five of these ideas, a couple things about them. One is I think they're areas of cultural overlap. And what I mean by that is these are areas where we agree with our culture. Our culture would say these are all good things. They're also in short supply, right? Our culture is also failing miserably at all of these. And so that creates a great opportunity where if we really embrace these things, we will stand out in a positive way. Right? I mean, I think that this would make a real statement. I also think, you know, usually you see a list like this and you think, okay, this is describing Christian community. And I think that it is. But let me just remind you, the context for this is slander from the outside. That's what he's talking about before, and he goes immediately on to talking about dealing with their enemies. I think this list is supposed to be our attitude, not just toward one another, but toward outsiders, and especially toward those who are hostile toward Christ. And so that makes, boy, that gives that a lot of punch then. To be harmonious and sympathetic and brotherly and compassionate and humble. You know how hard it is to be humble towards someone who is attacking you? But that's what he's describing. Because look, he goes right on. He says, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. This is that incredible superpower we talked about last week, the ability to treat people better than they deserve, just as we've been treated better than we deserve by Jesus. This is that expectation-shattering grace. In our culture, you throw a punch, you expect to get a punch back. That's how it goes. And so the idea here is that when someone comes after you as a Christian, that what they get back is something they never expected, which is a blessing. And this is the thing that can that can break that pattern, that can interrupt normal human interacting and introduce grace and Christ. And by the way, this takes a ton of humility. Because, I mean, the pride has to win, you know? Pride's got to settle the score. That's very hard to give back something better than what's deserved. And yet he says, for you were called for the very purpose that you would inherit a blessing. The implication here is that God will reward you when you do this. And so when you give back a blessing for a curse, one of two things is going to happen. Either that person's heart is going to be melted before God by grace, or worst case scenario, God will repay you for what you've done. And so we trust God to reward us in the long run. And then he gives a rationale. So see how the next verse says, for, that's connecting. He's saying, now, let me explain. Let me give a reason why. Because I've just told you to love your enemies, which is an astonishing, outrageous thing to say. And so let me give a reason why. He says, for, and then he quotes from the Old Testament, from Psalm 34. It says, for, the one who desires life to love and see good days must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. So this language here, this idea of, you know, if you desire life, if you want to see love and good days, if you study the Bible, you know that's like wisdom language. That's the language of, do you want to live a wise life? Do you want to live long and prosper? Then here's some advice. And he says that you should turn away from evil and do good. So why should I give a blessing when my neighbor gives me a curse? Because it's a wise way to live. Don't get ensnared with evil for evil. He says this is the wise way to live, to seek peace and pursue it, which is the word for hunt, you know, to stalk down peace. Peace must be pursued. And then he gives another reason. For, so one reason you should love your enemies is because it's wise. But another reason is he says that the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer, but the face of the Lord is against evildoers. That's such interesting language, isn't it? That idea of God sort of being turned toward or turned away from something. It's really kind of anthropomorphic, because God doesn't have eyes per se. Like, God's omniscient. So it isn't like God could be so focused on something that something else would escape his attention. That doesn't seem like a problem God would have. And yet there is this idea of God's sort of intentional focus, that God can say, I am dialed in on this, and I can choose to be not dialed in on that. And that this is evidently something that God can do. So the idea that the eyes of God are toward the righteous. How about Psalm 32:8? I will instruct you and teach you in the way in which you should go. I will counsel you with my eye upon you. That idea of God, like, I've got my eye on you in an encouraging way. I bet you all have a memory of being scared to do something as a kid, but knowing that my parents are watching me, and that gives me that extra confidence. At bedtime at our house, you know, nobody ever wants to go to bed at our house, but I noticed there were certain nights where my son would just throw an absolute fit and refuse to go upstairs to bed, no matter what. And there were other nights that he would be kind of compliant. And I figured out that there was a pattern to it. I realized one day, wait a minute, when his sister is already up there, he goes with no problem. But when no one is up there, he throws this huge fit. And I got this idea, like, oh, I wonder if he's afraid. And so I started doing an experiment where I would go up there and turn on the lights and say, come on up to bed. You'd come right up, no problem. So what I started doing is I started standing at the bottom of the stairs, and I would turn on the lights, and I would say, now go up to bed and I'll watch you go. And he would go. There's something about knowing that someone in authority is watching me as I venture out. This is the picture here. And he says here too, he says, and his ears attend to their prayer. This is another idea all over Scripture. Psalm 31:1 that Rosie referenced in her prayer this morning. In you, O Lord, I've taken refuge. Let me never be ashamed. In your righteousness, deliver me. Incline your ear to me. Rescue me quickly. Be to me a rock of strength, a stronghold to save me. That idea of his ears attending to us, or him inclining, it's actually the word for stoop down, that he stoops. You ever stoop down to listen to a little kid because they have such a little voice, and you have to lean over as you're walking and you're trying to hear whatever crazy thing they're talking about? That God inclines his ear. I have a dog who inclines his ear, partly because they're so big. This is my dog, George. At dinner time, when he gets hungry, he gets super focused on you. And so every time you talk to him, especially if you're going to ask him if it's time for dinner, well, I'll just show you. I captured the phenomenon for you.
Hey, George. Hey, George. Hey, George. George. Hey, George. Are you hungry? George. George, are you hungry? George. Hey, George, what time is it? Is it time for...
dinner is the rest of that sentence. So, I don't know if you can see the encouragement here. I think there's a huge encouragement here. This idea that if you're going to venture out, you know, why should I love my enemy? Why should I be these ways? Because when you do, God says, I am dialed in on that. I am watching everything you do. My ear is bent to you. I'm listening for every word. You tell me what you need. Because you're doing my work when you do that. You're following in my footsteps, and I am in on that. That's tremendously, you know, how much would that embolden you to live this way if you believed that that was true? And conversely, he says, the face of the Lord is against the evildoers. So yeah, they may be trashing you. They may be treating you unjustly, unfair. But know that God is like, I'm watching you. I'm not watching them. I'm watching you. And this, I think, gives us what I would call a humble confidence, that we can be incredibly confident, but not because I'm so great, not because I'm such a wonderful person, but because the God who I follow is great, whose eye and ear are inclined to me. He says, who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? I think this is coming right out of his thought about that God's face is away from those who do evil. It's like, don't worry about them. What are they going to do if God is for you? It's a good point. You know, try this thought experiment. Imagine that God said, all right, for the rest of your life, everyone you meet is going to misunderstand, mischaracterize, unfairly reject you. Oh, that would be terrible, right? But he says, but I will perfectly understand, and in the end, I will vindicate you for all eternity. Okay, yeah, right? That would be the only scenario where that would be tolerable. And he says, so who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. You might even thank God for the suffering that you encounter, because he will bless you. And so he says, do not fear their intimidation and do not be in dread. This is one more Old Testament reference. That's Isaiah 8:12. That's where God is telling Isaiah that he's going to go say things that people are going to reject and hate. And those people are going to be wrong, but Isaiah is going to be the only voice saying the right thing. In fact, in verse 11, he says, then God gave me a strong warning not to think like others think. So this lets us be fearless and bold as we stand out. He says, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. What does that mean? That's very, you know, sanctify. We don't use that word. So I always wrestled with that sentence. What does it mean to sanctify Christ as Lord in my heart? Well, to sanctify is like another word for that would be to hallow something. It means to put it in a special place, to set it aside. You know, if you win a trophy, you don't come home and like chuck it under your bed. Where do you put it? Where do you put a trophy? You put it up on the mantle, or you put it, you know, you put it in a place of honor. You hallow it. You sanctify it. And so he says, in your heart, you need to put Jesus in a special place in your heart. Namely, Lord. Throne. You have all kinds of things in your hearts. You have special things in your heart. You have special places for people and things in your heart. But it says, give the premier place, give the throne of your heart to Jesus. Let him be Lord and reign in your heart. always being ready to make a defense. So yeah, this, I think, is that idea of the audience of one. That as I go out there in the world, I'm going to have choices whether I can do what pleases Christ or do what pleases me or do what pleases you. And he says, let God be the audience that you live for. He's the ultimate judge. He's the one who's going to have the say ultimately. And he's the one who's going to bless you. And he has his face inclined toward you. I think this means to live with him as your audience. Man, what a picture. That would be a life that demands an explanation. I know a lot of you in this room. I know a lot of you who actually do embody a lot of these ideals. Imagine meeting a person who did all of these things perfectly all the time. This would be an amazing person. This would be a life that demands an explanation. And when I think about my experience of walking into a Bible study, it was these things that captured my attention and my curiosity. So this is how we should live. Live a life that demands an explanation. And then the other part of his command, have that explanation ready. So that's this part two. Let's think about the other half of what he's saying here. He says we should always be ready to make a defense to anyone who asks us to give an account. And it says to give an account for the hope that's in you. So I think that's kind of interesting because he's bringing up hope. You know, he brought up hope in chapter one, but here it is coming up here. I think he's just summarizing everything he just said. You know, if we live this life, that's a life of hope. You know, that's a life that is banking on something eternal, not just something temporal. And so I think he's summarizing, saying people are going to ask you for a life of hope. Maybe that is the thing that I saw in that Bible study when I came out. You know, yeah, my friends were cool and we were funny and all this stuff. But we didn't have hope in anything. In fact, we like to brag about how cynical we were. This world is short on hope. And the things that we put our hope in are real shaky. So to live as a person with hope in this world without hope, yeah, that would demand an explanation. That stands out. So he says a couple things. He says, always be ready to make a defense. And so the command, it's a command. And the command here is a mentality of readiness. Be ready to make a defense. And I think that what he means here is that be ready to explain the source of this hope. You know, you live a life of hope. Why? Not because you're like just happen to be an exceptional person. That's not why. It's not that I'm just an exceptionally hopeful person. I'm just really upbeat. You know, that's not what it is. It's that I have a source of hope, which is Jesus. And so if I'm living, if I've sanctified Jesus as Lord in my heart, and that's causing me to live a life of hope, and someone says, what is the deal with you? That's the answer. The answer is that I follow Jesus Christ. And I think that's what he means. And I think that the idea is that we should be ready for that. A lot of people, when they think about sharing their faith, they think of it as this activity, you know, this very stressful activity that I might get a bunch of courage and share my faith with someone else. Peter's really describing it much more like a lifestyle here, though, isn't he? Where he's like, no, your job is to be someone Christ-like because you're following Christ and let that attract attention to you and then be ready with what to say. In other words, representing Christ isn't an activity. It's a status. It's a full-time job. We're his ambassadors. And when I wake up in the morning and walk out the door, I'm representing Christ, whether I'm doing a good job or a poor job. Sometimes it's pretty poor. So what would it mean to be ready to make a defense? I really try to think through what would be the elements of this. One of them, I think, is a basic one would be to know how to explain the gospel. You know, we have a very clear mission from Jesus, which is to proclaim the good news. The announcement that God has provided a way of salvation in his son Jesus and the invitation to freely receive that by grace. That is the gospel. Our main job as Christians, our primary role is to herald the good news of Christ. And so that has to be included. Ready to make, someone wants to know what's different about you, there is your opportunity to state the gospel, to explain what Jesus is all about. Now, there's a couple other details in here, though, we could notice. He says, a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account. And that's kind of an interesting word. That's like more of a courtroom word, your account. That's like your testimony. You know, if you're called in as a witness, they ask you for your account. They're not asking you for a conclusion or to make some case. They're asking you to tell the facts as you saw them, right? What's your account? What did you see? And Jesus told his disciples to go and be his witnesses, right? Your job is to go and tell what you saw here. And so I think that the idea is this idea of your testimony or your account. That would be part of having your defense ready, would be able to explain how I came to this place, my own testimony. And I think that's a really good practical. Do you guys have you ever sort of taken this challenge to like write out your testimony? I was in a men's group one time, and someone brought this as an activity. We wrote out our testimony, and I thought that it was really dumb until I did it. And then I was like, man, this was a really good exercise, actually, to have to put into words. And the little program we did, it said every testimony should have three parts. It should have like a before and then a what happened and an after. So like before I met Christ, I was like this, and then what changed my mind, and then what has it been like after? And that author also said, I thought this was good. He said, you should have a 10-minute version of your testimony and a 3-minute version and a 30-second version. And the 30-second version is probably the one you're going to use. You know, if someone says, oh, I didn't know you were a Christian, you got 30 seconds, right? They don't want to hear a 10. They didn't say that because they wanted to hear a 10-minute story. So I think this is good to actually do the exercise of thinking through. When people say that to me, I didn't know you were a Christian, I usually say something like this, and it follows that before, middle, and after. I usually say, well, I wasn't always a Christian. I never thought I would be a Christian. And I usually describe a before where I say, you know, years ago, if you would have asked me what life is all about, I would have said everyone should do what makes them happy. And I don't see how anyone could argue against that. But after some years of pursuing that, you know, I found that that wasn't satisfying the way that I thought it was going to. And at a certain point, I got desperate enough to try something as crazy as following Jesus Christ. And since then, I've found to my surprise that that was really transformative, and I've come to believe it's true. And I might add something like, you know, I know a lot of people think that Jesus is a joke, and I was one of them. But I've come to see that I think there's a hidden greatness there that's won my heart over. And it's been the greatest thing in my life. Boom, there's my testimony. You know, when you make a big decision, testimonies don't prove anything. It's not proof. But it is very important evidence. You know, if you're going to buy a refrigerator, a person's testimony that it's a good product or a bad product might be a big part of that decision. Think about how many things you decide, what movies to see, where to go on vacation. A lot of the things you decide include, you know, how to vote, where to stand on the issue, this issue or that issue. A lot of those things begin with hearing what your peers' experience is. And so I do think this is a very important line of evidence. It's not the only one, though. So he says that word to give an account, but he also says this other word, defense. And that's a different word. That's apologia, which like the word apologetics. This is a formal defense. It's to speak in defense, to defend a position, you know, like in school, and the teacher would say, you know, choose a side and defend it, right? The philosophers in ancient Rome would make their apology before others, would defend their case. And that's the word he's using here. This is much more formal than a testimony. And I like that this is in here because something that I think a lot of people don't realize about Christianity is that it is a reason-based faith. Most people in our culture, they make their, you know, they say, I want to be spiritual, and so I'm going to see what resonates with me, and whatever kind of feels right and resonates, that's my spirituality. And they assume that we've all done the same thing. They assume that you're here because Christianity, like, resonates with you, and you like it, all right? But the Bible says that's not a reason to put your faith in anything. That's not a reason to believe in anything. That's called getting your ears tickled. The Bible says there's only one reason to believe in anything, and that's that it's true. that you actually believe it's true. The only reason you should be here listening, you're spending your beautiful day listening to me, blah, blah, blah. The only reason that's a good use of your time is if you believe that this is the Word of God. Otherwise, you know, listen, it's not going to resonate with us because God is, he's always, gosh, how much of 1 Peter has not resonated with you, right? We're not here because we just feel good about it. God says that your faith is a precious commodity. You should put it in what's true. And therefore, if you're willing to stand here and say, I follow Christ, then we ought to be able to articulate a well-reasoned argument as to why I think that is the case. We should be able to communicate lines of evidence. And God has given us many lines of evidence. We could break out into a six-week series of lines of evidence that God has given us. There are so many. There's evidence from the world around us. We look out at nature. You know, we look at the origin of the universe, right? We can study matter, but where did matter come from? Where does all this come from? And when you study that question, you find out that physicists don't have very satisfying answers. It's like, well, maybe there's a multiverse that burped out this universe, or maybe there's some divine being that we can't see that brought all this into existence, but it's not God. They're not very satisfying answers. Or you look at the fine-tuning of the universe, how all the constants that make our universe work appear to be very specifically adjusted. This is a great puzzle for physicists who don't believe in God. Or even just the Big Bang, which is accepted by everyone. And yet, how did this extremely perfect, how did everything come from nothing? How is that if you don't have God in the equation? Or you look at biological evidence. You know, put anything under a microscope and you find order and beauty. Look at the DNA that makes up, you know, who we are. This is data that is encoded. How can you explain where that comes from? The evolution of the eyeball. You know, anything that you study, it's incredible. Not to mention the just general appearance of design and order, that this world does not feel like it came from a random chance. Or look inside yourself as a human being. You're sitting here and you're like, I'm aware that there's such a thing as me. Well, how can that be? If we're all just matter, if we're all just random chance particles bouncing around, then there is no such thing as consciousness. There's not even any such thing as free will. I know you feel like you're making decisions, but you're just a super complicated machine, if that's all we are, is matter. The whole idea of people that have values, the whole idea of moral right and wrong. Do you believe that there are some things that are ultimately right and wrong? Why would that be true if we're just matter? We're just matter bouncing around. There's no right and wrong. And this is one of the strongest arguments for God, because most people in our society very strongly do believe that there are things that are absolutely right and wrong, and we're willing to argue about it all day online with each other. This is called the moral argument. The moral argument goes, if there is no God, then there's no such thing as absolute right and wrong, which is pretty airtight. And then the second premise says, there is such a thing as right and wrong. And that's pretty airtight too. And so the conclusion is there must be some sort of divine. There's biblical evidence when you look in the Bible and you find these ancient authors who made predictions across centuries that come together that we can demonstrate where those came true in incredible ways that point ahead to figures like Jesus. It's amazing. Take an example like the resurrection, which God says that, you know, this is a demonstration. I'm doing this in part to show that this is true. And when you do the historical research on it, it's a pretty incredible, singular event in history with a very strong line of evidence surrounding it. And the point is that these all converge, all these lines of evidence I'm describing, they all are these areas of science or understanding where we have big conundrums, and they're perfectly answered by the existence of God. Now you say, well, but I can answer those conundrums in other ways without God. And that's true, you can. You just need 20 different answers, and they're all kind of far-fetched, and a lot of them take as much faith as believing in God, if you ask me. So yeah, you can take God out of the picture and answer those questions. You know, maybe something came from nothing. Maybe everything came from nothing. Maybe we hit the cosmological jackpot on fine-tuning, and then maybe we hit it again on the origin of life. Maybe DNA is a random occurrence of chance nature. Maybe there is no such thing as personhood and free will, and we're just super confused. Maybe there is no right and wrong, which would be kind of a bummer, you know? Maybe a bunch of people, ancient authors, wrote down predictions that all happened to come true in a coordinated way. Maybe that happened. And maybe it's just dumb luck that a lot of those predictions point to a man, Jesus Christ, who turned out to be the most famous man in history. Maybe the disciples stole the body. Maybe everyone mass hallucinated together, which has never happened in documented history, but maybe it happened. And I realize I sound like I'm being snarky, but I just described the best answers to those conundrums apart from God. So it's pretty incredible, the argument for the existence of God. It's not proof, but it is a reasoned faith. And so, you know, I know some of you are sitting here and you're like, yes, I love this stuff. And other of you are like, oh, can we get off the apologetics? Boring. My challenge for you is to take the next step. That Peter is commanding us to be ready, to have a defense ready. So what's the next step for you in doing that? I know some of you are thinking, it's not my thing. Let the people who are gifted in apologetics know that stuff. You know, okay, fine. But here's the thing. Two reasons not to go with that. One is that you want your own faith to be durable. You know, you have enough faith for today, but what about when the challenges and hardships come? What about when that pesky doubt works its way into your mind? You want to be fortified. You want to know what the arguments are. That's one reason. The other reason is that we're God's ambassadors. And if I say, I don't need to know apologetics, you're assuming that anyone that you would interact with would be persuaded about God and for the same exact reasons you were persuaded. And that's almost never the case. When you ask people what changed your mind about God, you get a whole bunch of different answers. And so if you're only literate in the one area that interests you, you're going to the amount of people that you can influence toward God is going to be very narrow. Here's a book that Gary actually turned me on to called Reflections on the Existence of God. I really like this book because it's an apologetics book, but it's what I would call an entry-level apologetics book. The chapters are like three or four pages each. He covers a ton of topics. He gets a ton of information in there, but it's easy to read and interesting, even for the person who's not the apologetics person. All right? If you're an apologetics person, this isn't your book. If you're not an apologetics person, but you're convicted by what I'm saying, there's your book. I actually read this with a non-Christian friend of mine, and it was super interesting discussion. And so, yeah, I really recommend it. Anyway, the last point he makes here is he says, but do this with gentleness and respect. This is such an important caveat. Okay, we could stop here, but it's important what he's saying. Gentleness, that's strength under control. Respect is the idea of reverence, that you're treating another person with the reverence they deserve as a human being. You're honoring them. This is important because so many conversations about faith, including conversations started by Christians, you know, the whole stereotype is that Christians are not gentle or respectful. That they're pushy and arrogant and annoying and manipulative and hypocritical when they talk about the gospel. And so it's so important that we need to have gentleness and respect. You know, I think that it says those are the keys to making interactions about faith positive experiences. It should be a positive experience. I met with a guy over a period of about 6 months a couple years ago, and you know, he was trying to figure out what he believed. And so he was very argumentative. He likes to argue. And so he would bring up, you know, what about this? What about that? I read this online. And it was good training for me because he was just shotgun blasting me with objections to Christianity. And we would sometimes have heated debates, but I'll tell you, it was super positive. In fact, we both felt like it really developed a friendship between us. That's how it ought to be. It's not that I'm trying to arm wrestle you into what I think. Like, we're just both human beings trying to figure it out. But let's throw our ideas out on the table together and evaluate them. And I'm open to being challenged by your ideas. Because honestly, I want to know what's right. If this is wrong, I want to know. And so let's get our ideas out on the table and share those with each other. And that should be a positive experience. I think most people do wonder about the big questions, like what happens when we die. I think most people want to talk about it, but are afraid that it will be a bad experience, especially to talk to a Christian about it. And so we can debunk that by making it a good experience, and we do that through gentleness and respect. Learn how to be a good listener. Learn how to ask questions. Learn how to be genuinely curious about what they think and interact with it. To wonder, what is their point of view? And I want to understand that. To try to understand the other person's worldview. Your worldview is how you understand the world around you. What's your grid for making sense of the world? Everyone has a worldview. You know, my worldview was everyone should do what makes them happy. Or maybe your worldview is everything is matter and there's no spirituality. And whatever your worldview is, everyone has one, but a lot of times they haven't thought about it. And so we should draw them out. Help me understand how you view the world. What's your grid for viewing the world? And to help them evaluate their own worldview. Everyone has a worldview. Most people haven't done the work of testing it. Most people are afraid to test it because they know it's probably faulty. They say a worldview needs to be three things. It needs to be coherent, it needs to be cohesive, and it needs to be comprehensive. Three C's. That means coherent means it makes sense. Cohesive means it doesn't contradict itself. And comprehensive means that it covers everything, that it explains everything. Naturalism, the idea that we're all just matter, it makes sense. It's cohesive. It just doesn't explain morality, personhood, choice. Leave something sticking out of the box. And so usually when you start exploring someone's worldview, they like that because it's interesting. But it's funny, usually when I start asking people to describe sort of their view of the world, they get humble real fast because they realize how half-baked their worldview is. My worldview was totally half-baked. Don't be pushy or condescending. Don't overstate your case. Okay? The cases for Christ is great. So don't overstate it. And don't be defensive. Like, I can't believe you're questioning Christianity. Of course they're questioning Christianity. They should. Don't be defensive. Be open-minded to learning what they think. And be patient because God plays the long game. So there you have 8 through 15. Live a life that demands an explanation and have that explanation ready. It's a good challenge. If you don't have your explanation ready, then you won't be ready. And so I think that he is telling us to be ready for something here. And if you're new and you're visiting, then my challenge to you would be to spend a little time thinking through your worldview. Are you satisfied with it? And have you understood the incredible good news that's being presented here in the Bible? Because I think it's worthy. I think it's worthy to stand up there with any of the best worldviews and is head and shoulders above. I'm going to pray for us. Well, Father, thank you for the way that you've made us. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. Thank you that not only have you shown us who you are in Jesus, you've invited us to follow you along, to follow along in your path. And that is, it's truly astonishing. Thank you for the opportunity. We're not just waiting out the time for you to come back. You've asked us to follow along with you and to participate in this incredible way of life. And because you do that because you want to win more into your kingdom. So thank you for the privilege of doing that. Thank you for the knowledge that when we set out to do that, your eye is upon us, God, that your ear is inclined toward us. and that you want to hear and see everything that we're doing to that end. Thank you for the incredible privilege. Thank you for Peter's great encouragement. Help us to go and make a difference in this world around us. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.